Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us at the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at eplroundtable@gmail.com.
Hi, everyone. My name's Thomas Buff. I'm the editor of wolvesblog.com. Unsurprisingly, I'm a supporter of Wolverhampton Wanderers. You can find us at wolvesblog.com or on Twitter at wolvesblog.
My name's Sam Cox. I'm a Fresh Saints contributor, and you can find us on Twitter at Fresh Saints and freshsaints.com.
Awesome. Thanks to you both so much for joining us today. We'll start off with the transfer window, which, of course, ended on Thursday. So just curious to get your guys' initial thoughts on who do you think the biggest winner and the biggest loser was of the winter transfer window?
Yeah, I mean, just like I said to you, mentioned off air a second ago, Kev, that I think the biggest winner was the Premier League in general, because it was just indicative of clubs looking for more value these days and not just spending silly money for the sake of appeasing a couple of fans and you know, rolling the dice to maybe make their team better. I think the downturn in business is generally a positive thing, because I think clubs should be more considered and should be more responsible for what they're doing. I know that's boring. You know, some people like the all the fun and games on the transfer deadline day. But I did think generally the Premier League was the winner. You know, if I was going to pick a loser, you know, kind of contradicting what I'm saying, some clubs who probably could have done with getting some players in. I think you're always looking at the bottom clubs. And I'd probably pick Fulham. I think they wanted to do some business, which sounds bananas, really, when you consider the influx of players they had coming in over the summer. But you just felt they needed something. They need to do something with that defence. Ranieri said himself, I think, that they lacked leadership in that squad. I thought Gary Cahill may go there on a loan to the end of the season from Chelsea to get some games. Seemed like an obvious transfer. And he would be the kind of character that might lift them a bit. But yeah, that didn't really happen. So, you know, I fear for Fulham now. I think Huddersfield have gone already, but I think Fulham are sort of teetering on that edge. I know they had a good result against Brighton, but, you know, I'm just looking at that squad and the result they had yesterday and the mistakes they make at the back to gift goals to other teams. I just think that could be their Achilles heel. So I'd say Premier League, the big winner, and possibly Fulham, the biggest loser.
I'd probably second that with the Premier League being the biggest winner. But if I'm going to pick a team, I'd like to look at Bournemouth's window. They brought in Dominic Solanke from Liverpool, Nathaniel Clyne and Chris Meppham. Players have been on their radar for a long time and definitely fits the mould of Bournemouth, and they're able to get rid of some deadwood as well, and Jermaine Defoe get him off the wages, and Mark Pugh as well, a good servant for the club, but his time at the club was at the end and he's gone on loan to Hull. In terms of losers, you know, as you said then, you're looking at the bottom of the table because they're the clubs that need to do business more than anyone else. But I would probably say Huddersfield Town. They really needed they needed some players in to give them a lift. They needed an attacking player because they've been short for goals all season, and they only brought in Jason Puncheon on loan, who, from my perspective, when he played for Southampton, was a good player, but he's aged now. He couldn't get a game at Palace and other sides who are sort of down the bottom of the Premier League, and I'm not sure he's the type of player that would take them away from relegation troubles. And then they only brought in a couple of youngsters in Grant from Charlton and Brown from Tottenham, and now, as you say, Huddersfield are look all but down. They've changed their manager. The window wasn't inspiring for the fans, and I just think in terms of a biggest loser, I think Huddersfield were the team who needed to do the most business, and they just didn't bring in any real quality.
Don't you think, just as a comeback on that, Sam, don't you think that maybe their chairman was looking at it and thinking, actually, we're too far gone? You know, there's no real point spending 20 million on someone. It's just going to cause us headaches. Even if he does brilliantly, the deficit between them to 17, you think maybe actually it's better just keeping their powder dry, just going basically, and maybe, you know, punching and the lad they signed from Charlton, maybe that's one eye on the championship next season, thinking, you know, we want to have a strong squad ready to come try and make an instant return.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think their chairman has definitely got one eye on the championship next season. And as you say, the guy from Charlton and the youngster from Spurs. I think you're spot on with that. I think there's sometimes in windows where you look at the teams near the bottom and you think they should invest in the championship or younger teams just in case they go down. But the fact they also they part of company with Wagner and brought in another young coach from Dortmund's second team. I know they got Wagner from there as well. But I think they're spot on. Yeah, I think they've done, as you say, the polar opposite to Fulham. Fulham looked to be active in this window to stay in the division, whereas Huddersfield have almost resigned themselves to the fact that they're more than likely being playing championship football next season.
Yeah, for me, I do agree with your initial assessment that Huddersfield did the worst. And part of it is, naively, from the fan side up, that I've seen multiple Huddersfield fans on different platforms, whether it be social media or like live blogs and stuff like that, who all seem just so disillusioned with their Premier League stay at the moment that they're actually like asking to be back in the championship and looking forward to being back in the championship. And I think anytime a fan base's needle pushes that way, that's a failure on the ownership. That there wasn't, like, even if you know you're going down and you don't want to invest too heavily, surely you bring in at least someone that the fans can get excited about. Because yes, they did bring in cheap players that maybe helped them in the championship, but maybe you bring in up somebody else that can help in that point, like Cardiff bringing in Bakuna. Like, that's also a championship signing that will stabilize them when they go back down. But the fact that Huddersfield didn't do any of that is one of the reasons that I gave them one of the worst grades. But what I will say is two of the best grades I gave this window to on our full transfer show that'll come out later this week were Manchester United and then your own Wolves there, Thomas, and neither of them made an incoming, but both of them tied up players long term. So we'll start with your signing of Johnny. How just important is that for Wolves going through long term?
Yeah, good acquisition. There seems to be some debate over whether it's our club record signing, because we spent 18 million on Adama Traore in the summer. And the BBC and local media sort of had Johnny either at 15 million or 18 million, so it could be a record signing. But yeah, to get a player who was, he never played for Atletico Madrid, you know, they only bought him in the summer, which is just how crazy transfers are these days, that they bought a player, immediately loaned him out, and then 6 months later sold him for 15 to 18 million. But good business for Wolves. You know, we've had a try before you buy situation. We've had him for the first half of the season. He fits into our setup incredibly well, perfectly suited to that wing-back role. Not very much, you know, gets past him. I think he's a difficult player for even the best, you know, wide attackers in the league to get by. He's a full Spanish international, and you don't get many of those for less than 20 million. A very good signing. I'm you know, pleasantly surprised that we were able to do that deal. I think it bodes well for Wolves that they're able to attract a player of that calibre to sign for us long term, and hopefully, you know, more signings of that ilk to come in the summer to build on what's already shaping up to be a very good squad.
Yeah, but as for the ultimate winner, I agree with both of you. It was the Premier League, as I just kind of illustrated with the teams I gave the highest grades to. Two of them were ones that didn't bother to bring in players. And I think that, again, as we were kind of speaking pre-show, guys, that it feels like the kind of Sky transfer fetish thing has kind of been broken a little bit, and the clubs are now wising up and spending less money on flyers and waiting to make sure that their squad isn't unsettled by bringing in new players. That the solution in the media always used to be you have to add players to improve. And I think, fortunately, football, at least the Premier League, is starting to shift a little bit away from that. Next up, I want to talk to you guys about how your team set up against the big clubs, because we've seen two crazy results from the same team recently in Bournemouth. They go and beat Chelsea 4-0 at home, then they lose to Cardiff 2-0. And a reason why Bournemouth's both goal tallies and results are so crazy is because they basically always set up the same way. They're always going to come out and attack and play their style of football, but it will cost them points, but it also leads to some pretty big wins or surprising wins, like the one against Chelsea. How does your club set up when playing against the top teams in the Premier League?
I think Wolves have done very well this season. We've had results against more or less everyone. They took a point off Man City. We lost to Liverpool in the league, but knocked them out of the FA Cup, albeit a poor Liverpool side. Drew with Man United, drew with Arsenal, should have won that game, beat Spurs at Wembley. Yeah. So, there's a formula. And I think Wolves are they managed to do both things somehow, weirdly. They managed to sit in and defend for a long periods of the game and defend. But then when they have the ball, they use it very intelligently. And they're not afraid of committing men forward in the attack because they're so organised. They're able to shift between defence and attack very quickly. And I think that's why they've earned quite a lot of plaudits and why we are seventh in the league. It's very difficult. I think it ultimately comes down to the quality you've got. If you haven't got great quality in attacking areas, then you're a lot more likely to defend and then play those percentage balls forward and try and do things from set pieces, which is the traditional way of a lesser team trying to get something off the better teams. But, you mentioned Bournemouth, and what Bournemouth have always had in their time in the Premier League, from my perspective anyway, is good attacking players. So they are able to, they only play that way. That's how Eddie Howe sets them up. They want to use the ball. They want to get forward and get at teams. So I just don't think they've ever really had the personnel to sit in and be compact and just weather large periods of pressure. So they kind of have to play that way. But it is interesting because I think different teams have had success against the big six this season in, all different kind of ways.
Yeah, I think I would personally say Wolves' approach to the playing against the bigger teams is probably perfect. As you say, the results that you've reeled off there are fantastic results that maybe you weren't really expecting your club to have going into the season. In terms of, from a Southampton perspective, it's a bit of a difficult one, really, because we've had good results against big teams since Hasenhüttl was coming. We beat Arsenal 3-2 in his first home match, and we got a good point away to Chelsea at the turn of the year. Before that, when we had Mark Hughes in charge, we went to Man City and we played we didn't go with a five at the back, which we deployed earlier in the season, and we did get a good hiding. We lost six goals to one, and that was probably the sums up the Mark Hughes era at Southampton. Looking at other teams, I think from a perspective of a fan, I think I don't really mind how Saints play against the big teams if we get a result. It's the way we play against teams of similar status to us who are in and around us in the table. I think if you look at Newcastle, the only people complaining about Newcastle's style of play when they play against Man City or Spurs are neutrals who want to see good games of football every single game they want to watch. If you ask a Newcastle fan after their game against Man City on Wednesday, no Newcastle fan would be complaining about the way they played, because at 90 minutes, they took 3 points off Man City in a fantastic victory, 2-1. And for some parts in the game against Spurs, they were quite unlucky. I know Tottenham hit the post, but so did Newcastle, and then the goal that Son scored, the Bravka didn't really cover himself in too much glory.
Yeah, went straight through him.
Although you'd say he's been a great signing for them. So from my perspective, I just think these aren't the games where you expect points and where you're going to get your accumulation of points for the season. They're almost like extra games in the season that you can take extra points. So the only people who really complain are the neutrals who want to watch good games every week. As you say, as I've already said about Newcastle, they got 3 points in games against Man City and Spurs recently, and I think they would have they probably would have snatched a hand off for that return after those two games.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting point, because Jake, who comes on and talks about Newcastle with us, and I actually had a little mild post-match tiff, because he was saying that our win wasn't deserved, and I was very curious as to what he meant, and like laid out all the statistics about why Tottenham were better, and he was basically like, no, of course Tottenham were statistically better, just that they fought very hard, they set up well, and so he felt they deserved a point. And I do think that is sometimes the bias that I carry as a supporter of a top four club, and then the media kind of has a bias towards as well, because they want the big clubs to do well, to sell the big packages and everything like that. So I think it is very important to highlight that, you know, sometimes teams' goals in a match are not the same. And in that one, Tottenham intended to set up, or sorry, Newcastle set up to defend, and they did arguably as good a job as Tottenham did in attack until whatever it was, the 82nd or 83rd minute. So very interesting to hear your thoughts on that. We'll wrap up news and notes by talking about Premier League managers, because ever since the Huddersfield situation with David Wagner stepping down, there haven't been any other changes. And now that we're past the transfer window, it would seem more dangerous to get rid of who you have. Do you guys think we'll see any more managerial changes? The only time I can remember one much later than this was that year that Fulham had three managers.
Yeah, to answer your question straightforward, I don't think we'll see anyone getting sacked. I looked down the table earlier and I can't really see anyone who may go, really. It's just one of those things. I mean, Wolves actually did it the last time we got relegated from the Premier League. We, for some reason, in our infinite wisdom, decided to wait until after the transfer window had shut to sack Mick McCarthy. And we were relegated with a very meagre points tally. So it's never really a good move. I suppose there are a few teams at the moment where there's a bit of discontent. You know, we beat Everton yesterday, and a lot of their fans aren't happy with Marco Silva. But I'd still be surprised if they pulled the trigger there, because, you know, that seems like a project for him and still relatively early. Pellegrini at West Ham having a bit of a difficult time, but again, I still think, you know, he's building something there. Huddersfield and Fulham have already changed their manager, so I, you know, can't see that happening in Cardiff. So there's no obvious people that I would see going before the end of the season.
No, I tend to agree with you there. Looking at the table, the only two managers that you could really throw a case for being sacked would be Marco Silva and Claude Puel. I think, as you say, Marco Silva is at a start of a project there, and they've also sacked their past three managers since David Moyes, I think, in Roberto Martinez, Ronald Koeman, and Sam Allardyce. So that's, you've also got to look at the financial side of that. It'd be another payoff that they would have to do. As you look at my club, Southampton, I think we paid Mark Hughes off something in the region of about £5 million. And if you look at, we also sat Puel and we also sat Pellegrino. So we're in the sort of same situation where the payoffs for these managers are so large, it also hinders your sort of spending in other areas. Looking at the bottom of the table where changes usually happen, Huddersfield have already changed their manager, Fulham have changed their manager, Cardiff aren't going to get rid of Neil Warnock, Burnley won't get rid of Sean Dyche, Saints have already changed their manager, and Newcastle won't get rid of Rafa Benitez. So looking at the bottom of the table, the changes have already been made, and those who haven't changed the manager, their managers have previously done fantastic jobs and are also still doing a good job. So I can't see any changes there. And as you say, the only manager that could really lose his job, I think, would be Claude Puel. But they got a good result against Liverpool. I know they lost today against Manchester United at home, but that's not the worst result in the world. So, as you say, I think, and Claude Puel, I think they'll be given to the end of the season at least to try and turn things around and give himself a stake of claim for his job for next season, as results are starting to pick up a little bit. And of course, they're on the back of that tragedy earlier this season.
Yeah, the Puel situation is very strange. And some other time, I'd be very interested to get your thoughts on why Leicester seemingly want him gone as much as you did, despite finishing well with both. But I do agree. He's probably the one on the hottest seat, but I don't think it would be wise for them to shift now. I mean, they're in 11th right now. What do you have to gain by getting rid of him, other than potentially bringing your season in danger? And I think really the best part about this conversation is that it means we're probably going to make it out of the season without a panic hire of Big Sam or Pulis or Pardew or Mark Hughes again, who, you know, not to be too mean, but you picked up because he was basically driving Stoke into relegation, was the only reason he was available. So I think it's good that the Premier League is starting to not only get better about transfers, like we mentioned in the open, but also starting to look for more progressive solutions in management rather than kind of just going back to that same old well of kind of relegation surviving managers and instead looking a little bit further forward. All right, now we will take a quick break and then we'll be back with club-specific questions for each of our guests.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
All right, and we are back. Thomas, we'll lead in with you talking about Wolverhampton. Ruben Neves has been incredible for you this season. He scores a goal at the weekend, but then comes off injured. Just wanted to start by asking just how serious that is.
Difficult to know this early. I think it looked like he was holding his calf, so I don't know whether that's a calf strain, a kick on the calf. I think he was injured in the first half, and it's one of those where he tried to run it off. So I'm hoping it's just a kick. And he's back before too long, but I don't know yet. All I'd say is that I don't think he's as instrumental as a lot of outside supporters may actually think. Because I think we've got Gian Martino, we've got Leander Dendonk, and we've got Romain Saiss, and we've also got Morgan Gibbs-White, who has shown this season he's got some amazing potential. So we've got good players in that area of the pitch. So if he is out for a week or two, I think we can cope.
Very interesting, yeah, because a lot of neutrals do kind of imagine that Neves is the one that drives it, although Moutinho has been rounding into some pretty fantastic form of late. Another player that's become very, very important for you, well, arguably always has been, is Raúl Jiménez. I saw coming into the window, again, people outside the club, which is probably not the best source to go to, thinking that Wolves needed to sign a more reliable striker. But Jiménez does so much more than just score goals, but he's also scoring goals four in the last 10. Just how important is he to your side?
Oh, incredibly important. Incredibly important. He's a wonderful player. I go onto like opposition forums before we play teams, and they always say, oh, I don't think Jiménez is that good. They've got Jiménez up front. I don't know if he's going to be much of a threat. I mean, they haven't watched the games. It's as simple as that, because he's, as you mentioned, he's scoring, he assists. I think he's got, in all competitions now, he's got 10 or 11 goals, 5 or 6 assists. And, that's, to me, that's phenomenal. Start of the season, he was playing up on his own, with two wide players either side of him. Now it's more of a conventional front two with Jota alongside him, and those two have struck up a real partnership now, and I think that's taken Wolves up a level, which you've seen. We've reeled off a couple of impressive wins now, beat Leicester in that 4-3, beat West Ham 3-0, and beat Everton yesterday with a bit to spare. Jiménez, fantastic season up there as a possible contender for player of the season. I think we've got to pay Benfica 30 million for him in the summer if we want to make that transfer permanent. And I will be absolutely devastated if Wolves don't take up that option. I can't believe that they won't do that. I need to do more research into it because I don't know if we've actually got first dibs. I'm assuming we've got first option to buy in because I've got to believe there'll be other Premier League clubs looking at what he's done for Wolves and thinking, could we gate crash that deal? But I just really, really hope that he's a Wolves player next season.
Yeah, he's a fantastically well-rounded player and a really fun one to watch. So if people aren't watching him, they probably should start. Just for those wondering the numbers, which you mentioned, he is both scoring goals and assists. A player that has just as many goals and assists is Heung-Min Son, and he has more than Mitrovic, Sigurdsson, Mane, Firmino, Eriksen, etc. Like, that's the kind of returns that he's providing. So when people say that you need to upgrade the striker position, I often know that I don't need to worry about that person's opinion too much longer. It has obviously been a dream first season up in the Premier League. Is it matching or surpassing what your expectations were coming into the year?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely surpassing expectations. I mean, I think there were fans at the start of the season who saw the players we brought in over the summer and saw what we did last year and believed we would be very competitive. Some of them were even saying, yeah, top eight is achievable. I was always more reserved than that. I was always felt, it'd be great, lovely to stay up comfortably, which isn't something we've really done in the Premier League era. We've always, when we have stayed up, it hasn't been with much to spare. So I would have been content with, mid-table, just above that clutch of the relegation contenders. So to be up in seventh place and, with a bit of a buffer now after that win yesterday, it's fantastic. So it's massively surpassed my expectations.
Well, certainly congratulations thus far, and hopefully you can land a top 10 finish there by the end of the year. Coming to you now, Sam, to talk about Southampton. I mentioned the transfer show that will come out on this channel later this week. In it, me and Dave Hendrick, who was the other person on the show, gave Southampton a D for your transfer window. Do you feel that's harsh, or is that just about how you viewed that window?
That's probably about right, I'd say. We offloaded a few players who were high earners, were failed transfers in some respects, and that Hasenhüttl had assessed and realised that he wasn't going to use them in his system, and he saw the reason to let them go. But the big problem with that is that they're only loan deals, and none of them have obligations to buy. So the only way that they'll be staying with their loan clubs would be if they perform exceptionally well from now to the end of the season, which I hope they do, and that means we can get some money in from them. But Wesley Hoyt was sent off in his debut for Celta Vigo, and Cedric, I believe, was could have been at fault for a goal against Inter Milan across the weekend. So we're not too sure about how they're getting on, but we were able to shift some dead wood. I mean, Stephen Davis, who was a fantastic servant for the club, scored some great goals and some vital goals for us when staying up under Adkins and Pochettino and when achieving European football under Ronald Koeman. But again, it was time for him to be moved on. Gabby Adini, again, another player who had started brightly for Saints, but couldn't quite refine that form after a few questionable managerial appointments following Claude Puel, who seemingly got the best out of Gabby Adini. So, and then the fact that we didn't bring anyone else in, question marks were being asked. But as we said before the show, it's not, had this been the transfer window under Mark Hughes, then alarm bells would have been ringing that we didn't bring anyone else in. But the fact that we now have a manager as good as Hasenhüttl at the helm shows that, yes, we were a bit underwhelmed with the transfer window. We would have liked to have seen a couple of players come in just to rock the boat. And obviously, when you see players leave the club, you almost half expect players to come in. And when they didn't, that's why we're a little bit underwhelmed. But Hasenhüttl's been getting the best out of players so far. We've seen Nathan Redmond progress, James Ward-Prowse progress. And he's bringing youth players in, something that lost its way under Koeman, under Puel, under Pellegrino and under Hughes. That sort of bringing in youth, giving them a chance that Saints have been so renowned for, had almost gone. But now with Hasenhüttl, we're seeing players come in. Jan Valeri's well, forced Cedric to go to Inter Milan because how well he played and how impressed Hasenhüttl has been with him. We saw Callum Slattery make his first team, not debut, his first team start for us yesterday against Burnley. So, yeah, as you say, a D was probably about right if you're growing net because we didn't see any players come in. But it's not too drastic because of Hasenhüttl.
Yeah, also, under Hasenhüttl, you've tended to shift to this back three. You already mentioned a couple of names there, but who would you say that this new formation has most benefited?
I definitely say James Ward-Prowse and Nathan Redmond, especially Nathan Redmond. He's been almost given a free role. As you say, we play a sort of 5-3-2 with the wing-backs almost playing as right and left wingers to form a 3-4-3. But Nathan Redmond's been given a free role to be up front, to provide width, to get the ball from deep and drive at defences, and he's definitely stepped up and is flourishing under Hasenhüttl. He scored 6 goals in 10 appearances in all competitions since the Austrian came in. And yeah, if I'd pick another player, I'd probably say Jan Valeri as well. As I alluded to earlier, he sort of forced Cedric out of the side, and now Cedric's gone to Inter Milan. And it's always great to see a young player come in and do so well, because there was noises from the academy from the past sort of year and a half that Jan Valeri could be a player who comes into the first team, but we weren't really expecting him to do it so quickly. And yeah, it's been great to see another young player come from our academy and do so well.
Yeah, and then last up, I was curious about. Oh man, I just lost my train of thought. What was the first thing you said? Because I was going to ask a follow up, but I had already planned that.
About Nathan Redmond?
No. Ah, dang it. This is why you write stuff down. I don't know. What'd you say is a relevant question to ask? Sorry.
Relevant question. Probably maybe something about how we look different under Hasenhüttl to Hughes. I don't know. Maybe.
That's why.
Did we sort of do that one? I'm trying to think what would be a good question, because obviously we're going on to the player of the month.
Oh, I was going to ask about the match. That's what it was. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I just wanted to wrap by actually talking about the match yesterday. It seemed like you were going to all but secure the win, then a very late penalty with the whole Crouch situation, which must have been very frustrating for him to win that on his first day back. I was just curious your breakdown of that match, and were you pleased how you played but just disappointed by the result, or did you feel you needed to be better on the day?
I think the second half performance was very good. Burnley could argue edge the first half. They were stronger. I mean, you know what type of game you're getting when you go to Burnley, and that's not a criticism of Burnley. That's what's made them such a hard team to beat, especially at Turf Moor. So the first half, I mean, we had a couple of good chances. Danny Ings probably should have scored before going off injured, and we got very lucky in the fact that Ashley Barnes was most certainly brought down by Alex McCarthy, and the referee and the linesman for some reason thought he dived, which from, I'm sure, people who have seen it would say that the Saints were very lucky and we were on the receiving end of a good decision. The second half, we came out and we looked like a completely different outfit. As I said, Nathan Redmond really took the game by the scruff of the neck and did what Hasenhüttl wants from him, and that's from getting balls from deep, driving at players and being a real nuisance for back fours. And his goal was a perfect example of that, and it's another goal that we see of what Hasenhüttl wants from these teams. A few weeks ago we saw it from James Ward-Prowse, getting the ball, winning the ball back, driving at defences and taking shots on, and Redmond did that perfectly yesterday. As they say, he drove towards the back four, a cheeky little nutmeg on a former Saints player, Jack Cork, and it was a fantastic finish. It's obviously disappointing to draw a game at any point when you've been winning, especially in the 90th minute in added time. But on the basis of things in the first half, and obviously Burnley not getting the decision at the end of it, and the fact that it was a blatant handball, I know there's been a few Saints fans questioning, because there's been a picture that's surfaced of Crouch having a, looks like he's got a tug off Stephen's shirt. From my point of view, that's clutching at straws. It's a definite handball. There's no reason why Stephen should be jumping in the air with his arm like that. And yeah, looking at it a day on, looking at the result, it's probably a fair result that we both take a point from the game.
Interesting stuff for sure. It does seem better days ahead, and that penalty was very much a penalty, but we've basically made a decision on the show to just not really talk about penalty shouts anymore. Don't put yourself in a situation where a penalty can be called by the referee, and VAR will be here soon anyway. So, kind of on those points.
Yeah, but we get a bit lucky that VAR's not weren't using that much, because that was a certain penalty. That's just a stonewall.
Yeah, I actually think that they got multiple things wrong, because you really can't treat a referee and a linesman the way Barnes did either. So if you're committed with your choice, then that's a red card. But then that's just more wrong.
The game against Crystal Palace, Wilfred Zaha was booked for the incident, but Jendrell Prowse continued to shout at the referee,
And do the applauding. But I genuinely wasn't sure justice. Ashley Barnes wasn't going to attack that linesman.
No, it's when watching it and seeing, obviously, by being judged to have dived, almost being accused of cheating, which obviously is something that Ashley Barnes would not want to be accused of, or any professional for that matter. But that reaction was just a little bit too close to the edge, where I thought he was very close to getting a second yellow there. He was a little bit fortunate.
Yeah, very lucky boy indeed, but they do end up picking up the point, which sounds like you're saying was fair for both sides.
Yeah, I'd probably say it's about fair.
Yeah, right. Do either of you have any questions about Tottenham?
I'd like to ask just a quick one about the situation. I know you've probably been asked this a million times about the whole Poch thing and about Manchester United, but honestly, do you think of the transfer window's been, and obviously we talked about that we don't need to panic, but do you honestly think that Spurs' transfer policy at the moment would be the main thing that would send Poch to Manchester United?
Very interesting question. I do not, because we've slowly come to learn that Poch is one of the people that's refusing moves, that when Tottenham are approached with potential players, he's the one that's saying that they might not fit, or that he wouldn't fit them into the side. Oh, don't get me wrong. There's also blame on Levy, who isn't willing to spend on some targets that Poch probably would want to bring in. So they're kind of both the problem. I think the possibility of Pochettino going to United is for all of the reasons that have been put forth by the media, that they have more money to spend, his love of Sir Alex and everything like that. But something that I actually said on a recent appearance I made was, if Pochettino is such a devotee of Sir Alex, what would be closer to respecting that lineage? Would it be going to Manchester United to just be the next one? Or would it be turning Tottenham into what Sir Alex turned United into? I personally think it would be the latter. Everything he's ever said has implied that he would stay, that he's not interested in leaving. But of course, you wouldn't just say that you were leaving on the other side. So thus far, the column of reasons he would leave are all reasonable. The money, the fame, all that stuff. Finally winning trophies, which obviously is the stone that's most often hung around his neck. On the other column is everything he's ever said. And in my opinion, the trying to live up to the Sir Alex stereotype is something he can do more at Tottenham than United. Alex was at United. That is not shocking news to anyone. Yes, he could go there to fulfill that. But I think if he was really trying to honor that legacy, he would do it for himself. But admittedly, biased. But on the whole, no, I don't think the transfer policy would be why he would leave. If I had to pick a reason why he might leave, it would be if we lost Eriksen and Alderweireld in the summer. Because he's shown a priority of keeping the players we have over bringing in new ones. So if we aren't bringing in new players and we start to lose our better players, I think that could really be kind of the crux there.
Yeah.
So what do you think constitutes success for Tottenham now? Is now you're out for domestic cups, is it basically finishing third and giving a decent account of yourself in the Champions League?
Yeah, I think if top four, I'm still very confident in. I also said recently that we're not in the title race, but we're winning the heck out of the top four race.
Don't you think it's funny though, Kev, that if you turn around one fixture when you played Liverpool at Wembley, and I know Liverpool beat you with a degree of comfort, you had a late comeback at Wembley, but if you'd won that game, you would be top of the table now. Don't you think that's like crazy that you're not considered as even a footnote in the title race, when actually you're basically one result from being top of the table.
Yeah, and if City lose today, we're ahead of them in second. Yeah, it is kind of crazy. I just think we always have some issue that prevents us from being up there. And I'm not going to bring up the whole net spend thing. I think that's one of the duller arguments I ever hear. But yeah, no, it is crazy that we're that close. But I think we're that close because we've been on really good form. I mean, listen, we just won three consecutive games without Harry Kane and Dele Alli, right? Yeah. That is very fortunate. And as someone that believes that all things kind of regress to the mean, that means we're going to lose a few games with them that we shouldn't. That's just kind of how I view it. We could just get lucky the rest of the season. I mean, Leicester's latter third of the season, they won the title, was incredibly lucky. Obviously, they put in the effort. They had the players. Vardy was on hot form. But things just kind of tended to bounce their way. And thus far, things have tended to bounce Liverpool's way, quite literally, if you're referring to the Pickford incident in that Everton match. Yeah, I just don't see us up there. But that is an interesting point that we are that close. Yeah, I don't know. I really hadn't thought about if we had unturned them there. And then obviously we'll be playing them soon enough, as well as Arsenal and Chelsea here late February, yeah. Early March. But yeah, I think top three. And if we could get past Dortmund, that would be incredible. But still no Kane and Ali for that first leg. If we're down by more than two goals, even if we got Kane back for the second one, I think that hole will have been dug too far. But it is a huge shame that we went out of both domestic cups because of the absences of some key players. That having been said, the players that were on the pitch against Chelsea did incredibly well to take it to penalties, did incredibly not well in the penalties, but was pleased that they were at least able to get there. I've been very critical of Llorente, and I still will be, because I think his level of play is well below us, but he still manages to pop up with a goal every now and again, and I don't know what else you want from your backup striker other than to score and kind of keep you in matches. Mm-hmm. Obviously had the assists both against Watford and then against Newcastle at the weekend. So, yeah, we've been derailed a little bit, but as you say, we are still pretty close. If Kane comes back fully firing and Liverpool and City each lose a match, then maybe I'd be willing to start entertaining that conversation. But for now, I'll stick with my very quotable quote of not in the title race, winning the top four race.
Can I ask you just another quick one?
Yeah.
Just after you just said the Chelsea game there, I just wanted to, you might have already said it in previous pods, but what was your sort of thoughts to Pochettino's comments about not having to win trophies to progress to the next level, and trophies only build egos? Because obviously we know that trophies don't mean everything in football. But what is your sort of thoughts on Poch saying that? And there's that stigma around Spurs. Obviously, you haven't won a trophy since, was it the 2008 League Cup? So what's your sort of thoughts on that situation with the comments, and then obviously Spurs having, being knocked out of a semi-final sort of once again?
Yeah. Well, the first thing that came to mind was, you'd never catch a manager that's won stuff say that. So I thought it really highlighted that he hasn't. He has later gone on to clarify that we're obviously chasing the cups. We've been in, it ended up being four in the last five semifinals, four in the last five seasons, that is, multiple exits to Chelsea, including, I guess that would have, I don't think it was called the Carabao Cup back then, the Carling or League Cup or whatever it was called that year.
Was it the Capital One? I think that.
Yeah, may have been.
2 year spell.
Yeah, that we went out to Chelsea in the final. I do think that to an extent, you just have to win one before you start winning them, even though that kind of begins a chicken or egg situation, where how can you be winners until you've won, but how can you win without any winners? I think that was one of the reasons why it was so important when it got to the semifinals of the World Cup, that basically, unless Croatia won, we were guaranteed that somebody in this Tottenham team would win something, whether it be Belgium or England or France. Then obviously our captain Hugo comes back with a World Cup trophy and then puts up one of his worst seasons at the club, which isn't necessarily what one would have hoped for. But he has gone back and of course said that we are of course chasing the cups, that he didn't mean to that it was a difference in language, I think is what he really highlighted, that okay. Ego in South America has less of a negative connotation than it does in English as a language and England as a place. But it's still, you have to know better than to say that. I think is really where I landed on that. And again, I think the main takeaway from that is that it highlights that you haven't won anything, instead of maybe turning the narrative towards what you're doing to try to win one. But yeah, that's enough of me talking about Tottenham. So now we'll move into Player Watch, where I want to talk to you guys about who you think was your club's best player in the month of January. We'll start off with you, Thomas.
Yeah, I'll probably shortlist three. Jimenez, who we've talked about. João Moutinho, who's had probably his best period for the club. He's been pretty good all season, but he's weighing in with the assists and generally having a bigger say in matches lately. But the player I would give it to is Diogo Jota, who's just come to life, basically. He had a really difficult start to the season. It's come out recently that he was carrying an injury. He had to go and get that taken care of. He was out for a period, but then he came back in December, started playing really well. Unfortunately, got injured again, but then he's come back in January and been a real driving force. And, you know, we've won these three games recently because he's been brilliant. You know, he got a hat-trick against Leicester, and he was also instrumental in the wins against West Ham and Everton yesterday. So I would have to give it to him. When he's fit and firing, we are really a much different beast because we can score goals and we can hurt teams. Whereas, you know, the first parts of the season, when we just had Jimenez up front, we were kind of defending and staying compact and then looking to, you know, hopefully almost try out of, you know, blind luck at times to create chances. But we're creating more now and we look a more dangerous team. So I think Jota and his emergence are the reason we're doing so well. So I have to give it to him.
Yeah. And then for you at Southampton, Sam?
For me, without a doubt, it would be James Ward-Prowse. He came into the side when Højbjerg was suspended for four matches after seeing red again against Manchester City. And the thing with James Ward-Prowse is I've always been an admirer. I've always thought he's been a good player. I had the privilege of speaking and interviewing him not too long ago. And he's always just been a great character to have around the club. And I've always said he needs a run of games for us to really see the best of him and what people sort of expect from him. Under Puel, it didn't really happen. Under Pellegrino, he was given a bit of a run in the team, but nothing too substantial. And then under Hughes, he was almost frozen out. There was rumours that if Hughes was to stay, he was going to be moving on. And then Hasenhüttl was come in and given him the chance, albeit because of a suspension, but he's then taken that chance so well. And he scored three goals in the past four games. He's been influential on the ball. He's looking like he wants the ball. And I think that's the indication of confidence in players when they're always actively looking for the ball. They're not hiding away from trying to be influential in the game. And he stepped up and scored a really crucial goal against Crystal Palace in the week, and then he had the nerve to hold his nerve and score a penalty against Leicester in a crucial match as well. Mm-hmm. And his form has also been rewarded. I think he's been nominated for the Premier League Player of the Month. So he's one of those players alongside Nathan Redmond to really step up and answer his critics, because him alongside Nathan Redmond's been got a lot of stick last season, but James has sort of had a lot of questions, not a lot of criticism, but people were sort of questioning whether he could fulfill the potential that people had thought he could have, and I think he's starting to realize that now under a good manager. I think sometimes with players like James Ward-Prowse and like the youngsters, it's also about the managerial appointments who also can progress them to the next level, and I just don't think up until now he had that, and we're starting to see it.
Yeah, for Tottenham, if you looked at January on the whole, it would hard to look anywhere other than Heung-Min Son, who has just been fantastic. Obviously, he misses about three matches, I guess it was, total, while out on duty for South Korea in the Asian Cup. But that match aside, has three goals and an assist in this month already. missing that many matches. Obviously, two of them were the cup competitions that we went out of. If you want somebody that's actually been here the whole time, which would be a fair request, it'd probably have to be Harry Winks, who, you know, with Dembele's injury, Dyer's injury, Wanyama's injury, we've had to rely on a midfield of Moussa Sissoko, who we bought as a right winger, and Harry Winks, who was an academy kid just 2 years ago. And Sissoko also picked up an injury during that stretch. And so the fact that Winks was able to come into the side and largely keep up the level of the club, including winning that crucial winner against Fulham, is really huge. We've seen him put on really good performances against the likes of Barcelona and Madrid already in the Champions League. And I just think he's surpassed every expectation that those in the academy would have had for him. And it's really awesome to have another academy kid coming through and really establishing himself in the first team, so much so that we decided to not go out and buy a central midfielder in the window. I still think that was dumb and that we should do that. But the fact that we have that gap and that it is currently being filled by Harry Winks is incredible in and of itself. And then the fact that his performance levels have been so high during that stretch really speak to both his ability and his mentality. Although I will throw shade that is wholly unwarranted, because that isn't what the segment is about, at Christian Eriksen, who is often deemed as one of the best creators in the Premier League, one of the best players in the Premier League, and we really needed him to step up in the absence of Kane and Ali and Son, and he sure did not. So it'll be interesting to see how he performs going forward, because I've long had this theory that he performs well when we're performing well, and that he's not one of the causes. And if his form starts to pick up as soon as Kane and Dele get back, I think it'll be kind of another notch in the column of that argument. All right, and we will wrap up here with match previews. We'll start off with you, Sam. Southampton will face Cardiff at the St. Mary's. I'm assuming you're looking at this and thinking you need to win.
Yeah, it's a six-pointer. There's no doubt about that. Both teams are coming into the game with a bit of an upturn and turn in form, but as you say, it's a must-win game. There's no two ways about it. Cardiff have got a fantastic result against Bournemouth this weekend. After Bournemouth, we're coming off the back of a fantastic victory against Chelsea, so it shows that they have real quality, and they have real quality in the way they play under Warnock. And we know how difficult the game's going to be, but as you say, it's a must-win game. We could find ourselves, if the results go against us, if we lose against Cardiff and Burnley get something, then we could find ourselves back in the bottom three. Or on the flip side, if the best thing comes of it, we could be 5 points clear of Cardiff, and hopefully if Burnley don't pick up the points, we could be 3 points clear of them. So it is a really, really important game for the outcome of our season and for the way the second half of the season is going to go. We lost them away in December in Hasenhüttl's first game. Obviously, 2 months on from that, Hasenhüttl has been here for two months, so hopefully we'll see a more positive result.
Yeah, and then next up chronologically, Tottenham will be hosting Leicester. Still no Kane, still no Dele, but Son is back and not actually leading the line, which is what we expected. It was Lucas, and then obviously Llorente coming on to help seal that win. We should probably start to see some wing-back rotation again. Because Jan Vertonghen played left-back last match. I wouldn't expect that to be the case here. I would guess it'll be Rose and Aurier, or potentially Kyle Walker-Peters, who I rate really highly, but just doesn't seem to start the matches when it's his turn in rotation, which is an interesting development under Pochettino. Lamella has not really lived up to expectations in the absence of the big players either. I think what we're really learning is that while we have a lot of depth, it's always easy to add one or two of those depth pieces into our best 11, but as soon as it gets to be three or four, there's a significant drop-off. So I wouldn't think that he'll push for a spot ahead of Lucas or Son unless Son does play up front, in which case we just need another person out wide. Eriksen, Winks, I'm thinking maybe Wanyama or Dyer just to give Sissoko a spell, or it could be Winks himself that's given a spell, but because he plays a much less physical game than Sissoko, I think that's one of the reasons he's been able to kind of withstand this huge fixture congestion. And we do very much need his passing from central midfield. But it'll be an interesting one. Leicester are a very up and down club. We mentioned earlier, you know, they can go out and beat City and Chelsea, or they can lose to anyone in the league. Hopefully it's the latter. this time, and that they don't really have their tails up, and maybe we'll encourage an early Pujols sacking. But I do expect it'll be a tough match. Vardy tends to give our center backs trouble just because of his pace. Davinson probably the best one to deal with that, but I'm not sure if we'll continue to go back three, which we have been doing, to be fair, a lot of late, but we will need to make sure we take care of him if we are to win on the weekend. All right, wrapping up with you now, Thomas, you're going to be hosting Newcastle. It'll probably be the debut of Almiron. We're not quite sure if Neves will be back, but as you said, there are plenty of options that can step up if needed.
Yeah, be interesting game. You know, they need the points a lot more than we do. We played them a few months ago in quite a contentious game at St. James's Park, where they had a man sent off, and we got a last kick winner through Matt Doherty. I think there might be a bit of needle in the game as a result of that. I think Benitez will come and defend and be compact and make it difficult for us rather than coming out on the front foot. And we've generally struggled in those types of games this season. So it could be a lot more difficult than the table might suggest. You know, we've got Newcastle, Bournemouth, Huddersfield and Cardiff in the next four, which you'd say are four very winnable games. And considering we're already on 38 points, it's a real opportunity to cement that top half position. And, you know, even pull away maybe from the teams who are 8th, 9th and 10th. But, you know, it will come down to how Wolves play, whether they can maintain the consistency of performance they've shown over the last three games. And yeah, interesting, perhaps more so for what Newcastle might do. You know, business that their fans might not have anticipated they would do. They've done, they've broken their transfer record. They brought another lad in from Monaco, I believe. So they've got some players to introduce, but for that late winner for Tottenham, that would have been a real continuation. I still think there's a bit of a feel good factor now at Newcastle, which there hasn't been for a while. So I imagine they're going to come into that game with confidence and you know, adamant about getting a good result. So I'd probably tip us to narrowly win it because, you know, we're playing so well at the moment. Doesn't really matter who we are playing other than the big six at home. I would fancy us. So I'd probably say a narrow 2-1 to Wolves.
All right. Well, best of luck to all of our clubs when match week 25 comes around. In the interim, if you'd like to tell folks where they could find you or any projects you're working on, now would be a good time.
Yeah, you can just find me at wolvesblog.com and on Twitter at wolvesblog. We're on Facebook as well, facebook.com/wolvesblog. We're everywhere, wolvesblog, basically.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Mr. Sam E. Cox, and of course at Fresh Saints on Twitter and freshsaints.com for blogs and just all things Southampton.
Yeah, and I'm your host, Kevin DeVries. I cover the fantasy side of the Premier League for both ESPN and Goal. So if you're interested in those things, be sure to go check those out. As I referenced at the top of the show, we did our biannual transfer review with Dave Hendrick. That'll go up in two parts throughout the week, so just keep an eye out for that. Also, we have a championship show that you can catch on this very channel that is fantastic as well. So be sure to lend that your ear. Thanks to you two so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure as always, and we hope you keep listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.